I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency, radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication.
I am Tim Hansel, your host for the hour. Our guest is Dean Strang. He is a criminal defense attorney here in Wisconsin and has been practicing law for almost 30 years. Dean has defended men and women in criminal cases at the state and federal levels. And he's also done some appeals work and has offered oral arguments in the U.S. Supreme Court and the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the federal circuit courts. Dean is also, there's lots of work going on here, is also an adjunct professor at the UW Law School. He teaches courses there every year. And then from time to time, he'll teach a course at the Marquette Law School. But what we're here to talk about is his new book, his first book, just out. The publishing date is March 22nd, but the word is that if they've been shipped, so they're there. And the new book is called Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. And the book chronicles the 1917 trial of 11 alleged Italian anarchists convicted of conspiracy charges in Milwaukee against the backdrop of the First World War and hatred and fear of racial immigrants and a horrific bombing that occurred at a police station that killed 10 people just days earlier. This case also involves renowned defense attorney Clarence Darrow, who eventually gained the freedom of most of the convicted. But even his methods were somewhat suspect. And to quote the little blurb about the book, the entire case left a dark, if hidden, stain on American justice. So, Dean, welcome to A Public Affair.
Tim and Jim, thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the case. So the year is 1917. It's August, so summer. The United States had just entered the World War in April, and we had just passed the Espionage Act in June, I think that if that's correct. And so things were kind of tense in the country, and there was unrest. There was fear of immigrants and people who are different. And we have this bombing that occurs in Milwaukee, and then we have these people sort of days later who are arrested, not for the bombing, but for a separate incident. But it's all sort of tied together. So why don't you just talk a little bit about the history of the case, and then we'll get more into the trial.
Well, the case itself really does go back to late August 1917, and you're right, Tim. I think, in a sense, many Americans must have felt that the world was caving in on them at that point. We were 4 months into World War I, a war which, you know, the Great War was unprecedented in human experience before then. And you've also got the Tsar in Russia sort of wobbling badly at that point and then falling in late October 1917. So you've got the first Marxist experiment that, you know, that's about to be launched on in a country that spans about a third of the globe at its latitude. And in late August 1917 in Milwaukee, in comes an apostate Catholic priest who is now a Methodist minister, evangelical stripe to his work. He marches into an Italian enclave in Bayview, which has long since been incorporated into the city of Milwaukee, but at the time was a town of its own sitting right on Lake Michigan, south of the mouth of the Milwaukee River. And that little Italian enclave really sort of existed because of a steel rolling mill, vast steel rolling mill that sat on the lakeshore, torn down in the 1920s. But if you know Milwaukee, roughly just south of where the Port of Milwaukee Authority is today, there was this enormous steel rolling mill, and immigrants largely were the workforce there. The minister comes into the neighborhood on a Sunday afternoon in late August. He says to speak to the Italians about support for President Wilson and the war and their patriotic duty as Americans to be, or new Americans. Those in the neighborhood saw it more as an evangelistic mission. And, of course, he was preaching, this is Reverend August Giuliani was his name, was preaching Protestantism. And to the extent that any of these newly arrived Italians were religious, mostly they were Roman Catholic. So for whatever reason, the message didn't sit well. And on the third successive Sunday of his visits, a fracas broke out involving some of the people in the neighborhood and Giuliani's troop from his church. There were undercover police officers in the audience. When one of them roughed up one of the Italians, shooting broke out. Lasts all of a minute or two. But in the end, one Italian was dead. Another from the neighborhood would die several days later. Two of the police officers were grazed by bullets and suffered minor wounds. And then the police came through that evening and for most of the next 24 hours and rounded people up more or less indiscriminately, arrest now, ask questions later. And what shook out is that 11 people eventually were charged and awaiting trial in November, when on November 24, 1917, the bomb to which you referred goes off in the Milwaukee Central Police Station.
Okay, and this bomb, it's, do we know who did it? It had nothing to do with these 11 individuals, is that correct?
Well, certainly they didn't set the bomb themselves, and I don't know who did set the bomb. America's leading scholar of anarchism, Paul Avrich, who died 6-7 years ago now, attributed the bomb to a man named Mario Buda, who was an Italian born anarchist and a master bomb maker. Buda clearly was responsible for the 1920 bomb placed on Wall Street next to the J.P. Morgan Bank. I don't know whether Professor Avrich was right that Buda made the Milwaukee bomb or not, but in any event, the connection to the 11 who were awaiting trial in jail is that the bomb, although it blew up in the police station, really clearly was not intended for the police station. The bomb was found alongside the wall of Reverend Giuliani's church, alongside the outside wall on a Saturday afternoon, probably expected to blow up on a Sunday morning when the church would have been packed with congregants. And so the Italians in jail were assumed to have a connection indirectly to the bomb, or their supporters were, because Giuliani had been the antagonist in the Bayview fracas in early September.
So, however, tangentially, they were sort of linked. The two things were linked. And this was a pretty horrific bombing, right? I mean, killed 10 people, 9 of them were police officers, the people of Milwaukee were shaken, and that attitude clearly played a role in the upcoming trial in November. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the mainstream media, the police, and largely then the public after them all blamed the 11 Italians and their supporters for the bombing. And it was a horrific bombing. And It was the greatest loss of police life at one time in American history until September 11, 2001.
Really? Wow. So this title, I wanted to ask you about that, Worse Than the Devil. Now, is this in reference to the Italian people, the Italians who had been rounded up, or to anarchists, or where does that come from?
No, and I'm probably going to get that question repeatedly. The title really comes from a verbatim line from a witness in the trial of the Italians.
Okay.
It's a witness in the neighborhood who described one of the 11 defendants on trial as howling worse than the devil.
Okay.
Shortly before the melee breaks out. for which they were charged. And I liked the poetry of the line. Took out the howling, but left the worse than the devil.
Okay. So we have 11 individuals. They are locked up. They're waiting a trial. This bomb goes off. And then how many days later until the trial begins, and how does it unfold? What ends up happening?
Well, the bomb explodes in the police station on Saturday, November 24, 1917. Trial was scheduled to start on Wednesday, November 28. Now, in fact, the lead defense lawyer was stuck in Buffalo at an AFL convention, and much to the judge's disapproval, the real start of the trial had to be put off until Friday, November 30. But we're still talking 6 days after the bomb exploded, 2 days after the last of the funerals of the police officers who perished. And the trial physically is held just over a block from the Central Police Station. So visitors to the city hall where the courtroom was literally could have seen and perhaps smelled the police station all but smoldering.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, we are talking with Dean Strang about his new book, Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in the Time of Terror. And Dean has been giving us a little bit of history about this case, and it sounds really interesting. So, Dean, before our break, you were talking about the history of this case. We have 11 individuals who have been rounded up, and these are Italian immigrants. They are accused of being anarchists, and they have been rounded up in connection to a fracas that occurred in August that ended up resulting in the death of two individuals. Two police officers are wounded, and now it's November. But right before the trial begins, there is an explosion at a church. Was it at a church?
No, it was intended to be at a church.
It was intended, but it was found and brought to a police department and then exploded there, killed 9 police officers and 1 civilian. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so this, according to your book, this case left a dark stain on American justice, right? This is what the blurb said. So I'm assuming that these people did not get a fair trial, according to your research. Why don't you talk a little bit about what was so embarrassing about this trial from the standpoint of American justice?
Well, the trial certainly wasn't fair by at least the stated standards that we would like to apply to our justice system. But the stain, if you will, spreads further than that. It really... The whole case is marked by understandable and even predictable reactions to fear of outsiders, fear of radicals, but unfortunate reactions all the same. So, you know, from the moments after the fracas on September 9, 1917 in Bayview, you have the police descending on the neighborhood. You have arrests without anything like probable cause or, you know, a reasonable basis, which is all that means, going on throughout the night. The police knocking down doors, literally going door to door through the neighborhood and just rounding people up. People are held incommunicado for a week, 2 weeks, with no contact, their families having no idea what's become of them during that time. Third-degree interrogation methods, which were the norm, very, very common back in that day anywhere in America, but physically coercive techniques applied to extract confessions. So the whole trial is really tainted at its roots, and when you actually get to the trial proper, the judge refuses to move the case out of Milwaukee County. The citizenry really has been whipped up at that time by what you referred to a few moments ago as the corporate media, as we would refer to them today, the mainstream press at the time. Guilt is assumed by the media, by the police, and there's really very little pretense of a presumption of innocence. And, you know, so just beginning with the refusal to change venue or to postpone the trial in that sort of a heated atmosphere, continuing through allowing the prosecution to change its entire theory of prosecution on the morning of trial without any earlier notice to the defendants, and then just sort of lopsided evidentiary rulings during the trial by the judge, and repeated successful efforts by very aggressive and very fascinating prosecutor, the Milwaukee County DA at the time, Winfred Zabel, to inject the bombing into this trial, although the trial formally had nothing to do with the bombing at the police station, because, of course, the 11 people on trial weren't charged with that and had been in jail when the bomb was placed at the church and carried to the police station. So, you know, after 3 weeks of trial, 11 people, two counts as to all 11 people, the jury deliberates for 17 minutes and returns guilty verdicts against all 11. It wasn't a high watermark for American justice.
Now, what were the charges? Was it attempted murder and conspiracy? Or I found a little bit online about this case, but there's not much out there. I mean, you really found something that really was sort of a hidden sort of time in our history that I mean, it sounds like a fascinating case, but we really just don't hear about it. And this is in Milwaukee, right? We don't hear about it in Wisconsin. So what were they actually charged with or convicted
the,
for?
The main charge that went to the jury at the end of the trial for its verdict was assault with intent to commit first-degree murder on a conspiracy theory. And today there'd actually be a conspiracy charge, a separate crime of conspiracy. At the time, the prosecutors simply used the common law theory of conspiracy to prove that all 11 people were part of this assault with intent to commit first-degree murder. The objects of the intent to commit first-degree murder being the police officers, although, their wounds were minor. It was It was two among the people who lived in the neighborhood who actually died, having been shot by the police.
Now, these are described as Italian anarchists. And so there seem to be sort of two issues to think about here. One is the role of our fear of immigrants and also our sort of our fear of radicals, right? And so how much, I mean, did both of these play a pretty big role, do you think, in the hysteria and the run-up and sort of the railroading to the conviction?
They did. And to some extent, I think at the time, newly arrived immigrants weren't always distinguished from people with radical political ideology. And Italians may have been especially vulnerable to this at that moment in American history. The actual politics or ideology of the 11 people mostly is unclear. Mm-hmm. What is clear is that they were laborers. They were newly arrived to the U.S. The most educated of these 11 people had what would be the equivalent here of a fifth grade education, and all of that while they were in Italy. Most of them spoke little or no English. Some of them had at most one or two or three years of school. In fact, most of them had three or fewer years of schooling back in Italy. So it's very murky whether any of these folks were engaged in any structured way in, you know, an ideological debate of the day. What is clear is that they were newly arrived at the bottom of the sort of working structure, lowest paid, dirtiest, hardest jobs in America. And it seems pretty clear that America wasn't at that point living up to their expectations when they had left Italy.
Right. Well, it looks like we actually have a caller on the air. So, caller, do you have a question or comment for Dean?
Yes, I do. I've always found that period of U.S. history just after its entry into World War One. Very interesting, because up until that time, up until the declaration of war, there was great resistance against the U.S. joining in the war. It was felt that there was no need for the U.S. to belong or participate in what was viewed as essentially a European struggle. But then after the U.S. entered the war, which in itself was probably quite a dubious action, instantly public opinion changed 180 degrees, and anyone speaking out against the war in any degree was immediately prosecuted, arrested, imprisoned, much as these individuals in Milwaukee of whom you speak. So in a way, I think it's a good lesson in just how scary a mob rule can be and just how fickle public opinion is. I was wondering if you could shed any observations on that, and thanks for taking the call.
I think I didn't catch the caller's name, but I think he's right. I think his sense of history is good, at least as I understand it. There had been no great sentiment, I think, among the American populace to enter the war. It was viewed as primarily a European problem, if you will. Indeed, on the American left, there was strong suspicion that bankers and to some extent the shipping industry and large corporate interests were really driving President Wilson's decision to get us into the war. I don't know whether that's fair in the big scheme of things, but there was considerable sentiment on the American left to that effect. And the caller is also right that it's really not hyperbole to suggest that people were going to prison in this country for speaking out against the war. Emma Goldman, for example, and others founded something called the Anti-Conscription League very shortly after we entered the war, and gave public speeches urging people not to participate in the draft, to resist the draft. She and Alexander Berkman went to federal prison for that sort of advocacy. So it was a dangerous time. It's not surprising, I think, that once we made a commitment to the war, that in the main the American population rallied behind troops. We were sending young men over. They were beginning to die. Milwaukee lost its first young man in August 1917, just about the time of these events. So that's not surprising, but it is a lesson one wants to sort of hang on to, and that unfortunately our own course of foreign policy has invited us to revisit a number of times since.
All right. Well, we've been talking to Dean Strang, the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow, and Justice in the Time of Terror. This is A Public Affair, and I'm your host, Tim Hansel.
Very interested in this period of American history, specifically Milwaukee history. Now, was there a socialist mayor of Milwaukee at this time?
There was. There was at this time, and I'm pausing because I guess I'm not 100% sure that the mayor at that moment was a socialist,
yeah.
but I think so. There were three Socialist Party mayors during the 20th century.
Into the 1950s, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, actually, when I was born in Milwaukee in 1960,
yeah.
Frank Zeidler was still the mayor or had just left the mayor's office. He was the third and last of the socialist mayors in that city, but Emil Seidel, I think, and certainly Daniel Hone. The district attorney here started off as a member of the Socialist Party in one office.
Really?
In his first stint as a socialist, and then in his later stint he did, World War One changed him into a Republican.
Well, of course, yeah. but Republicans were a different stripe at that period of Wisconsin history in particular.
They were.
Well, actually, I should turn it back to you, Tim.
No, go ahead. No, if you have a question.
Maybe there wasn't a socialist mayor at that time because they could have perhaps brought some sense of justice into this sorry situation in 1917.
Well,
maybe so, maybe not. I don't know.
Maybe not. As I say, at the time of this trial, the district attorney himself was at least a professed Socialist Party member. He didn't do much of anything to bring justice into the proceedings, and he actually turns out to be a fairly troubling figure in Wisconsin legal history.
So it looks like we have a caller on the line. So let's see, caller, what's your first name and your question or comment?
Hi there, this is Clint. I was just wondering if you could comment on any prominent Italian anarchists from that era that may be influencing some of the actions or folks, the immigrants here. I'll take my comments off air.
Sure. The suspicion was that the Bayview was primarily Gallianist. That is, that to the extent that there were anarchists active and living in Bayview, that they were mostly followers of Luigi Galliani, as opposed to Errico Malatesta or some of the other Italian anarchist thinkers of the era. The evidence was pretty thin that Galliani had much direct intellectual influence in Bayview. For example, you might have expected to find copies of Cronica Subversiva, which was an Italian language anarchist newspaper published out east, I think in Bear, Vermont at that time, that was Gallianist in its leaning. The police uncovered, you know, literally boxes, hundreds, maybe probably thousands of pages of literature, if you will, pamphlets, newspapers, that sort of thing. Cronica Subversiva was not among the trove that the police took from the neighborhood. And I think that probably the reality is that most of these people were discontent with the America they found. Some of them professed either a socialism or a socialist anarchist point of view, whatever that meant to them. But most of them really were apolitical and discontented in the main.
So let's we've been a little remiss here that part of this story is Clarence Darrow, and he gets involved at the appeal process. Is that correct?
That's right. Tim, Darrow's first involvement is on appeal. The trial ends in shortly before Christmas in 1917. The 11 defendants are sentenced two or three days after Christmas, 1917. In 1918, then the appeal gets going in earnest, and Darrow is retained to represent all 11 on appeal.
And for those of you who don't know, Clarence Darrow is probably the most prominent criminal defense attorney in American history. That he is sort of famous for the Scopes Monkey Trial. He defended Leopold and Loeb. And his career was quite prolific, but you don't hear about this one. What was sort of interesting about Darrow's involvement in their appeal? So this was appealed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and I believe that the case was Bianchi versus the state in 1919, so this was 2 years later. So how did he come on the scene?
Well, I make the claim in the book that Darrow is, to this day, the American who's most American lawyer who's most famous for being a lawyer. I mean, we've had a lot of lawyers who are famous because they're politicians or, you know, what have you. But I think that Darrow probably still is the lawyer most famous simply for being a lawyer. That claim is debatable, but I don't think it's extravagant. So what's interesting about his involvement, one, is that Darrow is not an appellate lawyer on the whole. I mean, he handled some appeals, but he's not known for, famed for being an appellate lawyer. He's a trial lawyer. And a social agitator, a public intellectual, Chautauqua circuit speaker. But appeals were really something that he didn't seek out. And of which he handled relatively few. So that's one thing that's interesting. It's not as unusual that he would be up in Wisconsin. Darrow handled a number of cases, especially at the trial court level in Wisconsin, being proximate to Chicago. And in fact, handled a quite famous trial early in his criminal defense and labor law career in Oshkosh, involving the Payne Lumber Company up there. So that's less surprising that he would be in Wisconsin. But if this book makes a real scholarly contribution, it may be in the material I uncovered about allegations that Darrow was, along with the district attorney Winfred Zabel, part of an agreement to try to fix this appeal. I mean, the allegation really would be that Zabel sold his office to try to get the convictions reversed on appeal, and that Darrow joined in that agreement. I can't prove that it actually happened, but it starts with sworn testimony from an assistant district attorney who inculpates himself in the plot to fix the appeal, and describes a meeting that he and his boss, Winfred Zabel, had with Darrow down in Darrow's office in Chicago, where, according to this assistant district attorney, such an agreement was struck.
Now, was this for – now, this is all – this isn't proven, but is your hunch that this was for personal gain, that this was for money, or was it because that Zabel felt that justice was not carried out in this case, or was it something else?
It was something else if it happened. what is clear is that both Zabel and this assistant district attorney, whose name was Frederick Groley, what is clear is that the two of them, during the course of the trial, had received death threats in the mail. There had been an approach to Groley's family, a very frightening approach, late at night in the driveway by somebody who appeared to be armed, in April of 1918. So while the appellate record's being put together, two bombs are discovered outside Winfred Zabel's house. They didn't blow up. They were discovered before they blew up, but it's clear there were very serious threats against the lives of the two prosecutors during and after the trial, and at least somebody put a couple of bombs outside Zabel's house, so these weren't idle threats. And as the assistant district attorney testified in a grand jury several years later, he and Zabel were about at their wits' end. I mean, were really frantic with the threats against their lives, and decided to go down and take the train down to Chicago and talk to Darrow and tell him, look, we're worth more to your clients and their supporters alive than we are dead. And they proposed fixing the record, altering the record of objections and exceptions at trial to try to assure that the Wisconsin Supreme Court would spot error and reverse the convictions if Darrow would reach out to the Italian community and try to call off the threats against their lives.
Wow. So in order to right this injustice, we have some backroom deals possibly going on, or at least at the very least some shady behavior on the part of Darrow.
Maybe. Yeah, look, there's self-incriminating sworn testimony from a participant in this supposed scheme, and there's some corroboration from others that the trip occurred and that perhaps an agreement was struck. But what's wonderful and just sort of puzzling in the end about this is that although the Wisconsin Supreme Court did, in the end, reverse 9 of the 11 convictions, and in fact bar a retrial for 7 of the defendants outright, the Supreme Court did that on grounds that couldn't have been contrived or falsified. So if in fact there was a scheme by Zabel and Darrow to fix the appeal, in a sense, they sought corruptly to fix an appeal that the defense was destined to win honestly on the merits.
Oh,
so as so with so much about Clarence Darrow, of whom I'm very fond and a great admirer, as with so much of Darrow, there's a great deal of sort of murkiness and ethical complexity that seems to follow him.
Well, that's definitely interesting.
So, Dean, you mentioned the corporate media of the time. That was really like the Randolph Hearst and the newspaper moguls who were engaging in yellow journalism, I believe that was the term of the time, which could also be applied to this as far as their coverage of this case.
Right. I mean, we would think of them as the corporate media today. I mean, one of the things that got cut out of the book, because, you know, I'm not skilled enough writer to have it wander all over the place, but one thing sort of interesting is that one of the daily newspapers in Milwaukee at the time was the Wisconsin News and Wisconsin Evening News. That was owned and run by Mo Annenberg, father of Walter Annenberg, who later becomes famous as part of President Reagan's kitchen cabinet. And I think there's a school of journalism named after Walter Annenberg. But his father, Mo Annenberg, ran one of Milwaukee's daily newspapers. Fascinating and also somewhat troubling figure in American history, worth a book of his own, but just not my book.
We have just a couple minutes left here, and Dean, I just have a question. This is such an interesting topic. This is one of these cases. This is a miscarriage of justice that we just don't hear about. What is the lesson that we should take from these sorts of stories and this sort of scholarship?
Well, the very personal lesson for me as a practicing lawyer is I wish Americans and the public in general would get past descriptions of officials and authorities and judges and prosecutors and understand that every single player in our justice system is human, makes mistakes as all humans do, has the foibles and the failings of all humans. It's a very, very human justice system. And one that I think would work better if it operated with more humility than it does in all of its facets. And we've got to be, in the vein of that humility, really suspicious or cautious about our ability to deliver justice, especially to outsiders and people who are simply square pegs in a round hole world. Especially when we're in a time of high nativist sentiment or fear.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, for joining us this hour. Our guest was Dean Strang, and he is the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow, and Justice in the Time of Terror.
This has been a great public affair today.
Yeah. Tim, thank you for having me.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening.